I think it's fine. I think it's not.
Who knows?
This is the Wilson building, you know. I ran into this.
Was Camp coming down or?
I think they're bad. I think they're.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is the House Interim Committee on Economic Development and Trade, and today is indeed the 10th of January. Today, colleagues, we are going to be concluding our interim work and actually moving toward the introduction of measures. But first, let me say that we've got a little bit of scrambling to do because we're starting late with several of our members that were held over in the General Government Subcommittee of Ways and Means, which covered, I think, 13 measures in 90 minutes.
I think it was 14.
And they just concluded a few minutes late. Also, Representative Marsh is going to be presenting today, but she is scheduled both here and in revenue. So I'm going to be watching for her arrival so that we can consider her her presentation. I also wanted to welcome Representative Helfrich, who is joining us just for today.
Yes, sir.
But welcome to the committee. I'm glad we had enough room for everybody.
Thank you.
I also wanted to particularly recognize Ms. Leone, who's joining us today as our new committee administrator.
Welcome.
And, of course, Mr. Rosenberg is back in the corner keeping track of everything and making sure that we don't make any critical errors up here at the dais. So let me just outline what the game plan is for today's consideration. We're going to start with an informational meeting and cover the three bills that we are looking at introducing later in the meeting. And just to give you some background information, give the major proponents of those measures an opportunity to outline where we land on issues that we've been discussing for the past several months. We are going to then also take some time for any members who would choose to give us background information that on measures they expect that we may be seeing before this committee when we convene and during the short session. And then finally, we're going to move into work session where we actually introduce hopefully the three measures that that have been crafted for us. So any questions on the outline here today? So I'm going to exercise the chair's prerogative to adjust the schedule a little bit, and I would like to begin with disaster assistance. Again, I'm going to open the informational hearing, and I'm going to start with disaster assistance and economic resilience, which is legislative concept 83, and invite Mr. Jason Lewis Berry to come forward. Welcome.
Thank you.
And, of course, members will recall that we spent some time in recent meetings talking about the impact of the fire season on businesses and economic development throughout the state. That then moved us toward the consideration of some legislative addressment of the problem. Mr. Berry, if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and give us a little bit of history and let everybody know where we landed.
Great. Thank you, Chair Gomberg. My name is Jason Lewis Berry. I'm the Governor's Advisor for Economic Policy and the Director of the Regional Solutions Program. All right, might have to do this way. Okay, so Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, thank you for having me back. As the chair said, I know we've had parts of this conversation in a couple previous iterations since last fall, and I'm happy to be back to provide an update. And I think a lot of this will be pretty familiar, and I know you have a tight schedule today, so I'll try to keep things humming. And just to kind of start, we are just a reminder of kind of where we're in the big picture here. These fires, of course, that happened late last summer going into the fall, you know, were a big economic blow to the state overall, but particularly two regions. And we know that the fire, the smoke, the road closures had a huge impact, in particular the Eagle Creek fire up in the Gorge area, and then, of course, the Chetco Bar fire, which affected Southwest Oregon. In the short term, our response was really about how do we help businesses, especially small businesses, and how do we help workers in those businesses get through the initial stress of that period. And so some of you who are from these regions might recall some of the open houses we had to support both the employers and the employees. And then in the longer term, there's a question that I think we've all been wrestling with, it, which is how do we build up the economic resilience of our local economies, especially in areas that could be affected by future disasters of various types, and make sure that there's still a very clear message here that Oregon is open for business. So if you're talking about tourism going to any parts of our state, or if you're talking about businesses that want to have some reliability of operations, that they know that this is still a wonderful place to visit and do business. I'd like to start by acknowledging and thanking the folks who served on the governor's two fire recovery councils, the economic recovery councils. So their names are up here, and I'll acknowledge Vice Chair Representative Brock Smith, of course, was our chair for the Southwest region. So with much appreciation to you and your team down there. And then in the Gorge, it was Representative Mark Johnson, former Representative Johnson, as well as Senator Chuck Thompson, who helped drive that process. And it's great to see Representative Helfrich here, who I know is already dipping into these issues as well. But these folks really did a great job. We appreciate their service. They met several times starting in roughly, I think it was in October, through to even just a few weeks ago, I think in some cases were the last meetings. And they provided an assessment, digging in more detail to what the impact was in their regions of the fires economically, and then a set of recommendations that were very helpful to our office to consider how the governor's office and state agencies could help respond to the priority needs. And while I'm thanking people, I do want to also give some kudos to folks in various state agencies who I thought did a great job of reaching out to local businesses, employers, employees, and finding ways to help them. That includes other partners like the SBDCs, some of the local economic development partners like McHead and the Gorge. So a lot of folks, I think, really did a full court press. So just talking kind of at the macro level, combining the types of things that we heard from these two councils, here are the four broad points that we heard. One was the need for access to capital for small businesses. And we can talk about this theme a little bit later in my slides and talk about LC 83, which this committee has very happily been pushing forward. So that's one. Another is environmental issues. For example, in the Chetco Bar area, we heard a lot about concerns about landslides, and well, we've heard that in the Gorge as well, frankly, but also watershed safety issues down in Chetco. So we heard about those kind of concerns and have taken some steps. Public safety is a big issue, and particularly we hear in the Gorge. There's a lot of concern about the implications for potential search and rescue and how to keep people safe and whether our emergency responders in those areas have the type of training and equipment they need to do that. And then lastly is maybe that more macro thing I hinted at earlier, which is how do you protect Oregon's really great brand and the really great brand in these two regions as a place for business and visitors. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the steps we've taken on that. So first, we know the budget environment we're in, so our first instinct was, okay, of the priority needs that we heard about from these two recovery councils, what can we address with existing resources? And the list you see on the screen are the things that we've managed to get to, and I'm pretty pleased with this list. And some of these things have already been delivered, like the $30K for the watershed study in the Chetco Bar area. Others are still in progress, but basically we are confident that we will be able to deliver on these. So it's everything from some of those environmental things like the steelhead survey and the riparian restoration to Travel Oregon helping kind of on the big picture aspect of pushing more money to these areas to continue to promote their tourism, and some safety things like landslide risk mitigation. So this is a sampling, and if anybody wants to dig in deeper into any of that, happy to. Then here are the things that as we started to hear the priorities coming up from the councils that we realized, you know, we may not have the right program already existing or money in place to address that need. So one of these I'll also talk about in a couple slides, but it's regarding economic resilience planning. So you have communities like the Brookings area, you have towns like Cascade Locks and others who have said, you know we get hammered when there's an event like the fires last summer, but it could frankly be any other type of major economic disruption. It could be another type of disaster or something else, where they say, we want to pivot our economy to develop more resilience so we're not just dependent on a particular single industry at a particular peak season, for example, that you have in some of these areas. How do we prepare for a different kind of economic future? How do we identify which sectors are most promising for our community? So that type of analysis and planning has been identified as a need. Item two will relate to this LC 83 that we've been talking about, which is the possible need for some different type of loans for small businesses. So we can talk about that in a bit. I mentioned the potential need for training equipment for first responders in the gorge. And then one of the items that we heard from the CHETCO Bar Council from Representative Brock Smith and his colleagues down there was an opportunity to do some kind of a citizen science type of educational and tourism initiative in the wake of these fires to help people capture that as a learning opportunity, but also a kind of a tourism opportunity as well. Okay, so to dig into a couple of these things that I just flagged as potential new requests, and this one is going to be a new request in a way. It's an existing program. So the LEOF, Local Economic Opportunity Fund, is a program that already exists in statute. It's in Business, Oregon. And we, per the recommendation of the councils and per the governor's office support, we would like to see that program funded. It was created some years ago, but it has not been funded. And the thing that we would like to see that program do is support the kind of economic resilience planning that communities like Brookings and Cascade Locks and others have been asking for to help them get ready for a different kind of economic future so that they can sustain these kind of hits that they had in this last fire season. And frankly, that they're ready to capture new types of economic opportunities. I think this is something we see in rural communities around the state where there's an acknowledgement that maybe the way that that community used to generate its economic livelihood is no longer the most viable way, but they don't have the staff, they don't have the resources to do their own type of study to figure out their new opportunities. So that is going to be an ask coming in short session for $500,000 to support those types of economic resilience planning. And the other thing about these is that it unlocks a lot of federal funds. So there is the Federal Economic Development Administration provides some money for this type of planning, but they, I don't know if it's require or just strongly suggest that applicants demonstrate there is a state match to unlock those funds. So these funds would help deliver some federal funds as well. And then to the legislative concept 83 that the chair mentioned up front, and that this committee is moving for consideration. This is something that we dug into. We identified very early in the Recovery Council deliberations that small businesses were really concerned, those who took a hit from the fires, that they could, frankly, keep the capital flow to even stay in business and be able to come back next spring, next summer. We have begun to dig in on the ground through the good work of officers from Business Oregon and from the Regional Solutions teams more broadly and some of our local partners to try to understand the exact needs in terms of capital and loans that some of these businesses have. And we generally have the impression that, yes, there is some kind of a gap between what the feds can offer through, for example, the Small Business Administration and what is available through local lenders, other institutional lenders. But we don't know enough yet to say here's what a new program should be. So we acknowledge that there's more homework that needs to be done. So I think the approach that the chair has recommended makes a lot of sense to me, which is to direct that a study be done to really understand what type of potential new program, if any, is required to support small businesses in this kind of situation. That is the end of the presentation. Be happy to field any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Lewsbury. And again, the evolution we've gone through here is after identifying the problem, we suggested that we might want to try and establish a loan fund to support small businesses. And the initial number on that fund was somewhere between $2 and $3 million. Then after digging in a little deeper, we decided that it was more appropriate to get a sense of how that fund might operate and who the beneficiaries might be and how they might qualify, and that rather than allocating funds for a loan program, that we actually study the loan program first. And the consideration was for an outside consultant in the neighborhood of $500,000. And then ultimately, we came back and said, we've got some darn fine researchers here within the building. Why don't we conduct this research project in-house with your cooperation with no price tag. And that's where we've ended up here with LC 83. The other thing I want to just mention in anticipation of an entirely appropriate question from Representative Post is that this measure does indeed have an emergency clause on it. However, we would need that emergency clause to begin doing the research, or we wouldn't be able to get it done in time for the following long session.
And I took note of that, and I agree.
I'm sure you did.
Thank you.
So, colleagues, this is a little bit of the background where we are on LC 83. Do you have any questions for the governor's office? Co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Lewis-Berry, for all of your work. I appreciate all of the efforts as the chair of the Jetco Bar Recovery Council. My question is a little off topic here, but to that, and that is, where are we in the process with regards to the recommendations that have come out of the councils?
So, thank you, Representative Rocksmith. Many of those, I think, have been addressed in one way or another, kind of on this slide. I think the two recovery councils would look on here and say, oh, yeah, here was a recommendation, a request that we had. We can see that that's being dealt with. The couple of outstanding ones generally end up on this slide where we're still trying to figure out the new resources. So I feel pretty good that most of the asks and recommendations from the two councils are able to be met or are in progress. It's possible there may be one or two that we can't do in the near term, but we'll keep working with you all and with local partners to figure out how to do that. I think something like the Citizen Science Initiative is one of those that we're trying to figure out where it fits, but I know I'm happy to continue working with you and others to see how we might be able to do that.
And the trail maintenance?
And I'm sorry?
The trail maintenance?
Trail maintenance is another one. I'm not sure yet where it fits.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Additional questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will return to LC 83 later in the meeting today, but now I want to continue the informational hearing and address Legislative Concept 81 dealing with broadband technology, and I'd invite Co-Chair Marsh to lead off. Did you want to do that from here or from the witness table?
Do you want me to run through the concepts that are suggested today? So
please.
I can do that from up here, and then I'll move down there to talk about a specific concept later in the presentation. Sound okay?
I defer to you.
Okay. So, colleagues, you all remember at the end of the last time we came together, we talked about trying to advance as a committee bill a subject matter on broadband, although we didn't have very well-defined ideas about what that might be. In collaboration with the chair, I have been working on the possibilities of this over the last couple of months. And today we have several presentations for you, some of which may lead to some amendments that we'll want to further develop to put into the broadband bill, which you can see the legislative concept right now is quite minimal. It's really a placeholder. So I think our work today is to say, are there some concepts out there that we'd like to further develop so that we can consider them in the short session? Certainly in our fairly short history as an Economic Development Committee, we've touched a number of different subjects, but over time I think it's very clear that broadband has really emerged as a key economic development issue for our consideration. Clearly there, if you look across the needs of the state, there's probably no greater factor than the availability of fast broadband and the economic sufficiency of our communities. So today we wanted to start off, first we invited the director of the state information officer, Alex Pettit, to come forward. I don't think that we have ever heard from you in this committee. And he's going to give us an overview of broadband initiatives that are underway within his office. We also have representatives from the Department of Education to talk about another concept that I think would fit well into our bill. And then I have a small concept of my own that I'd like to present to you for consideration as well. So
Representative Marsh, how would you like the panels to proceed?
Well, I would suggest that Mr. Pettit start us off because he has the most broad perspective on what's going on in the state in broadband.
Well, welcome.
Okay. Chair
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. My name is Alex Pettit. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the State of Oregon.
Hi, Representative Gomberg, co-chair Representative Marsh, co-chair Brock Smith. My name is Melody Riley. I'm the Chief Technology Officer with the Office of the State CIO.
So to kind of frame this a little bit, I guess, our responsibility, my authority is for the State of Oregon sites, the State of Oregon facilities. There are some 640-some facilities across the state. And the connectivity for those sites. So everything from a fish camp to a DHS office to a Department of Transportation facility to a Department of Motor Vehicles facility and so on, and ranging in places across the state, obviously. We have, and because of the telecommunications, so the way that we have done this in the past, we have struggled like most of the rural providers or most of the rural communities have is finding broadband services that are available to us that we could use. Some of our facilities have as poor of connectivity as slow as 1 megabit per second, which is functionally for a telnet session, for a mainframe session is adequate, but anything really beyond that, and you're not really, it's not really broadband. And we pay anywhere from $3,500, as much as $3,500 a month for some of these very slow sites. So the state, in cooperation with the Oregon State University, has undertaken a network, a procurement of a fiber that will cross the state. And I will now turn the presentation over to Melody Riley. I wanted to be sure, though, that what we have done and what our authority is for the state agencies that we provide the service to. One of the things I've said in other committees, if the objective of our network was to have the slowest possible network at the highest possible cost, then we have certainly achieved that objective famously here. So,
all right. Thank you again. My name is Melody Riley. I am the Chief Technology Officer as of early November of 2017. So I've been able to appreciate the honor of taking and helping move these broadband initiatives forward. The broadband efforts have been going on, and we have been looking at this out of our office for some time. And so we wanted to provide you with some context, some of which Alex has spoken to already. And this kind of gives you a picture of the state of Oregon's network today. So on the left-hand side of that blue ring is our current state core network. We pay about $2.5 million a biennium leased for that core. As you can see, it's mostly around the I-5 corridor and the Willamette Valley. Next to that is a picture of the entire state with more circles. So you could take a look at the size of the circle represents how much we are paying for our remote circuit. So the smaller the circle, the smaller the amount, the larger the circle, the larger amount. In that, we've noted the amount that agencies are paying per megabyte. So the average can range anywhere between $1.33 per megabyte all the way to $1,039 in some of these remote areas.
That would be per month.
Per month, yes, thank you. This also kind of highlights the challenges that we currently face today. Again,
excuse me, Ms. Riley, Representative McEwen. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick question. Can you tell me what the difference between a remote location and a spur is? Sorry, I don't understand the difference.
Yes, thank you. Chair Gomberg, Representative McEwen. So the spur is coming off of our different main sites. Our remote sites are really what we also call the last mile, which are the sites that go directly to an office, a field office, a park site, that type of thing. So those are the remote circuits that we refer to.
Is that helpful? Did that answer the question?
I'm still not clear, but
we have what?
You have four spurs and a lot of remotes.
Chair Gomberg, Representative McEwen, members of the committee, thank you for the question. They are the core sites are the ones that are on that blue ring mm-hmm. or close to it, spurs off of it that come directly off of that. Those are what we call, and those are generally our least expensive sites comparatively. Those that are those dots that are further afield, those are the ones that are what we call the remote sites. They have a dedicated circuit to it because there is no facility out there that the state owns in order for us to leverage any kind of a synergistic cooperative type of a use of it. So it's a dedicated circuit out to, let's say, Joseph is one of the locations, or out to not Klamath Falls, but Fort Klamath.
Fort Klamath.
Mm-hmm. Things like that. Those are going to be the sites that are dedicated circuits, because we've not brought that together synergistically to have a core network that would serve them.
Thank you.
Representative Post.
Sorry to take the extra time, Mr. Chair, but I want to back up for a minute because I missed something. We're talking about just state offices and buildings. We're not talking about folks, the people. Did I miss something somewhere?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Post, members of the committee, thank you for the question. Yes.
Okay.
Follow up, please.
Because I must have lost something somewhere. I thought when we last talked, we were talking about trying to bring broadband to people, not state agencies. So I'm concerned because I have a GMC truck that's downstairs that gets 1 gig right now, 100 feet from it. And it's only costing me $10 a month for unlimited 1 gig. You see where I'm going? I'm like, holy moly, the numbers I'm hearing, I can get that. Let's have the state do that.
Chair Gomberg, Representative Post, members of the committee. The reason is because in many of these locations, because of the geography, I have a Chevy Suburban, and I too get through the. It doesn't work out in when I go on to Steens Mountain. I don't have any connectivity. It comes up and says that my network is not available. My Wi-Fi network is not available. So these are locations that simply don't have access for whatever reason, whether it's out by. And I've noticed this in the. So I've hiked. Black Butte, I don't have connection there. I've hiked, I go South Sister, I don't have connection there. So there are many locations where we have field offices, like a fish camp or that simply don't have that as access. That's simply not an option. Sure. And in those cases, we've had to use the dial-up, basically a dial-up connection, and we pay for that connectivity to those locations.
Okay.
It's that or do without.
Okay.
Let's continue.
Okay, thank you. So this next chart basically shows you certainly the services that we provide out of the Office of the State CO, Enterprise Technology Services. We've gathered these metrics of the current services we provide to our customers representing the various agencies. So the blue bars really represent the amount that agencies are paying for broadband. So no surprise, those agencies that have field offices, ODOT, Department of Human Services, have a lot more field offices, so they spend a lot on their various connections. However, price per meg changes. So when we look at Oregon Parks and Recreation, they certainly pay a lot more in the price per megs because of those remote locations that they don't have access to the fiber or to more of our core.
If I may also add on to that, this is reflective. We believe that this is representative of the problems that rural Oregonians are also facing, whether they're schools or businesses or municipalities or counties or whatever. That basically this is that we feel this would be a representative sample of the overall. Without having done a comprehensive survey, this is what the state does at 640 sites.
And you can see also in the list of bullets next on the left also highlights several of our challenges in terms of our bandwidth limitations. So we just have offices that are just getting connectivity. Maybe they're dial-ups, and they're really not able to access the different services in an effective manner, nor do they have maybe the resilience that they're hoping to have in those particular sites. Provisioning that we do, getting new sites set up is a fairly long, arduous process, and we hope to improve that as well. We're also working through the vendor management and the internet service providers and telcos in improving those relations and ensuring that we can also reinforce service level agreements. As we were, and particularly as I've gotten started, I'm trying to understand more and more the broad needs that we have in the state. And so, as Alex mentioned, we have been working on a partnership with higher ed. We, as those discussions had started, we began to look at some common interests and some shared needs. This map highlights not only the state of Oregon and higher ed needs shown with the diamonds, but we were also looking at the schools. The schools are sites that our higher ed partners could potentially extend their services out. So you can see throughout the state the locations of that. We also have a chart that indicates where most of the sites are located. So again, no surprise with the population centers where a majority of our sites are located.
So for a point of clarification, the executive branch is strictly prohibited from providing that service to the schools.
So the two main broadband efforts that the Office of State CIO has been working on is the regional middle and last mile RFP. So this is to replace our communications special procurement, those that we connect with and work with internet service providers, and allows us to leverage the collective buying power not only for the state of Oregon and the agencies, but also ORCAP members. ORCAP stands for the Oregon Cooperative Procurement Program. So this also would allow local governments, schools, libraries, tribes to also leverage these particular contracts. Again, the intent on this is to leverage our buying power, help reinforce better service level agreements from these different vendors, and improve bandwidth across in those insights, again, for those ORCAP members. The other one, what we've recently branded, is called Oregon Fiber. What this is a Oregon Fiber partnership. So this is a partnership between Oregon State University and the Office of the State CIO. We just entered into a two-party intergovernmental agreement for a term of 25 years that allows us to purchase IRUs, or indefensible rights units, basically two strands of fiber over, and the routes that we've identified, which I'll show you shortly, over 2,000 miles of fiber routes spanning across the state. There are also other research institutions that have also joined into this partnership. University of Oregon, Oregon OHSU, and PSU are two are the other schools that have been participating in this. And the idea is that not only do we have a need from the state of Oregon's perspective and all of the different offices that we have throughout the state, but higher ed certainly recognizes the need for access to higher bandwidth for their research and connecting. And then additionally, we've seen that there's some opportunity, again, through more from the education and higher ed standpoint to support those schools and libraries, which, again, we are prohibited from serving, but our partners with the universities are not. This just shows you in the middle and last mile RFP kind of the scope, again, highlights the different stakeholders who can leverage these last mile contracts. Oregon Fiber.
Excuse me. Yes.
Thank you. Just a clarification, Chair, if you don't mind. When I'm looking at the circle, mm-hmm. And it goes state government, higher ed, K-12, local government, how far does local government go? Cities and counties, do you go as far as watershed districts? I mean, how far afield do you go with local government?
Chair Gomberg, Representative McEwen, I know that the local governments, I don't know to the extent how far that goes, and those are detailed out in the ORCAP members, and we can certainly follow up with a list of
those. Be curious as to where that ends.
Sure.
Yes. Thank you.
And as I mentioned in Oregon Fiber, as we've been working on establishing that partnership, as I said, there was an intergovernmental agreement that was signed. It was signed in early November, allowing us to start proceeding with this partnership and the purchase of these IRUs. We've since worked to establish a governance structure. We're calling it a proto-governance structure, partly to kind of get us started. And so this highlights the decisions that need to be made for the operating level agreement, the initial planning for identification of the fiber routes that we have. We have an initial set of fiber routes that we're looking at, but in terms of the sequencing of establishing those fiber routes, the equipment that would need to be installed across the state, points of presence that would also need to be installed. So we would be looking at kind of our current investments and what we pay today and the coverage for our different sites, and then help sequence those throughout the course of the implementation. So in addition to the Executive Council, so the Executive Council would be made up of the CIOs of the participating organizations, Office of the State CIO, in addition to the higher ed universities. Dr. Pettit is co-chairing that with Lois Brooks, who is a CIO of OSU. The CIOs of the other institutions are also there. We have an Executive Steering Committee. I'd call that more of a working steering committee, of which I'm a member of, and we've been working more on the project plan, implementation, beginning to put the governance structure together, communication, stakeholder analysis, and that type of thing. We've also begun doing some outreach and really looking at areas of opportunity, possible collaboration, really trying to increase that mutual awareness. I've been very much focused on a lot of the data that we can get our hands on to understand the various needs and potential collaboration that may be out there with those parties that are involved, in addition to working with, like, Department of Education, City of Portland, we've been in contact with, Mid-Columbia Economic Development District, we've also been in touch with. The other groups below that are advisory groups. So we have a member, or you could also think of that as a customer advisory group, which we really look at what are the business needs, the strategic directions that maybe these groups are going that would demand higher bandwidth and maybe some opportunities. Then a technical advisory committee that really looks at the technical architecture requirements. We would also include security as a component of that to make sure that as we're establishing the network that we address all security needs in there as well. And finally, a business advisory, really focusing more on the budget, legal, procurement, those types of things. We would also be looking at either a policy advisory, or we could also identify a committee that would look at some policy-related implications. The blue, other light blue boxes around there really highlight that there are other groups that also exist in our current operations and at a strategic level, which we recognize are stakeholders or could be in the some of the decision making that we would have for not only the implementation but the operation as well. We've also developed a charter to kind of get us started in the Oregon Fiber Partnership. One of the key items in there are the principles that we have listed. And so we wanted to really kind of highlight some of the key things that would really help us for decision making. This is a high-level draft broken up into different phases, and wanted to kind of just highlight some of the bulleted items that we plan to do over the next several years. I'll go to the fiber routes next, which really highlight the current potential fiber routes that we've been working on with Oregon State University. So Oregon State University and this partnership that I mentioned in the intergovernmental agreement, they're actually the ones that are holding the specific contracts. They've been negotiating contracts with various vendors on the purchase of these IRUs. So these routes have been identified. We have identified that there are shared interests for our state locations as well as for higher ed. So the routes in red really kind of highlight and show you those potential routes. There's others on there that are potential routes of interest, but we wanted to highlight certainly those bolded in red. We wanted to also share with you the current partnerships that are going on up to this point, several of which I've already mentioned in the hearing today. And then there's a lot of other potential partnerships that we see as we're having further discussions. So with Business Oregon, State Library, and so forth.
So the routes actually run as far as Seattle and down to Sacramento and then to Boise. And so one of the things that the state is looking at would be cooperating with them. The universities have an interest in it for a variety of reasons. That's why the routes go as far as that. We really wanted to emphasize for our part to it, this is a financially as well as from a governance standpoint, right now this is a partnership, an equal partnership with the with Oregon State University. So we co-own all these routes in red as they finalize their contracts, and we expect to begin the process here with this RFP completion. We begin to convert our existing facilities over to this new core network.
Very good. Colleagues, any questions for the Chief Information Officer, the Chief Technology Officer? Please.
Mr. Chair, question. So I see potential partnerships with MCED, being a former MCED board member, but also attending one of the meetings that they had at the Clackamas, or the, in the Dalles at the community college there, Columbia Gorge Community College. How close are those partnerships to being created? Because I know that for Wasco, Sherman, and other counties out that way, trying to get the high-speed internet is an important economic driving engine for them. And how close are those partnerships being established?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Helfrich, thank you very much for the question. So, yes, I've been in recent contact with them. Right now, we have been exchanging information, sharing with them, and letting them know about some of the broadband initiatives that we've had. They've done a lot of research in those particular areas. So in terms of identifying areas of opportunity, those discussions have begun. But I would say we're probably in our early stages of those, but definitely have made some really good contacts in sharing information.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Gomberg, Representative Helfrich, members of the committee. We have identified 7 schools that are within 5 miles and several that are actually within 1 mile of one of these fiber routes that are unable to, or that right now cannot get broadband access above 100 kilobits per second. Not megabits, kilobits. That's a dial-up almost level of internet connectivity. And so we are trying to prioritize as well by need and articulate or identify some of that and reach out to them and figure out how that partnership either with Nero or someone else could work.
Yeah. Chair Gomberg, Representative Helfrich, I'll elaborate a little bit more on specifically on the Mid-Columbia Economic Development District. One of the schools that Dr. Pettit is talking about is actually a South Wasco school, 217 students in this particular school. We were looking at the proximity to the fiber, and so they are within a mile of the fiber. So it really highlights some opportunities. Some follow-up questions that I had of them is validating, you know, that they are indeed experiencing these performance issues and that they're having. I believe from some of the information that they shared with us recently, some of the new technologies that they were trying to employ, they have some of the technologies, but the connectivity and the bandwidth is lacking. And so they've got these devices kind of in hand. However, maybe they're really not able to experience its full benefit without better connectivity. And so these are definitely something we're following up on.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Marsh.
Thank you. So it's very interesting and exciting to hear what you're doing, and it sounds to me like you started off in one place, and as you go down this path, it gets ever expanding as you see the potential for more partnerships and more ways to serve our communities, our schools. I'm wondering if in this process you expect to come up with some sort of very broad-reaching recommendations as to how we might structure and pursue broadband in the state.
Chair Gomberg, Vice Chair Marsh, members of the committee, thank you for the question. We have proposed, and the governor's office is having those discussions now. It's not, it hasn't been, the priority for the governor has been, at least the task that I've been given, has been primarily around the making government more efficient and finding those efficiencies in 640 sites. That's certainly a task worthy of my attention and anyone's attention, clearly. To your point, though, there, as we're aware, and getting back to some of those earlier charts, there is a need with that for broadband in rural communities in Oregon. It's very clear. My my wife's business that she started, simply everything that she does is online. It could not start in John Day. It just, there would be no way for her to run that business the way it is in a place like, because there's no facility out there. And so that is one of the things. So one of the things that we're talking about internally is balancing return on investment. So for the state to realize the greatest return on our investment is if I convert everything that's along the I-5 corridor first. That cuts my cost the greatest to state government. On the other hand, if I were to light that fiber that's in rural Oregon, arguably that would give the opportunity for others, for rural communities, rural schools, rural, to realize the benefits of it sooner. So the direct answer to your question is it's in discussion. We do not have a plan thus far. Those are really fundamentally the two issues that were, I don't want to say they're mutually exclusive. It's a priority. It's a matter, order matters. It's a matter of order right now.
Chair Gomberg, Representative Marsh, one of the items so that we have identified in our roadmap is called an edge strategy. And so really what that means is, at least for the scope of what we're talking about and any of the edge sites that the Oregon State University and higher ed partners can provide connectivity to, is to provide recommendations of the kind of equipment that they may need to factor into their sites. Because even though the fiber may be available, there may be equipment that they may need local to their facility, and so providing guidance in that regards is part of the plan.
And so to that, to build on that a little further, Business Oregon does provide infrastructure grants, although mm-hmm. there's never been given an infrastructure grant for information technology. One of the discussions that is going on is, would that be an avenue for doing this, is providing those infrastructure grants for acquiring the equipment that's necessary to get onto a 100 gig circuit.
Additionally, the state library, I met with a state librarian recently, and she also indicated that there may be some things that they can provide out to not only the local libraries in terms of assistance, but possibly can extend that out to other community partners.
All right. Well, if there's no further questions, thank you both for joining us this afternoon. Representative Marsh, where would you like to take us next on this topic?
Oh, well, I think next we would invite Rick Crager and Carla Wade up, if that's agreeable to you.
Absolutely.
And I'll just provide a little bit of introduction to them. The day after this committee last met in November, I attended a meeting of the Broadband Advisory Council, because I sit on that body. And in the context of that meeting, became aware that there was an opportunity for the state to develop what's known as an E-rate match fund that would potentially allow us to spend a very small amount of state funding to be matched, perhaps at a rate as big as 10 to 1 to put fiber in schools, in particular in rural Oregon. We have some experience with doing this. And yet having the structure of a fund already ready to receive money would make this process much easier. And it seemed like a great potential bill idea for us. So today we have Rick and Carla to further expand on the whole concept and tell us what it might involve.
Welcome.
Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rick Crager, Assistant Superintendent for Finance Administration at the Department of Education. And with me is Carla Wade. She is the Digital Innovations Lead and actually the really smart person in terms of this particular program, and will be providing you some overview of our E-rate matching program. First of all, I want to again just thank Vice Chair Representative Marsh and the members of the committee for having us. We are always very excited about coming in front of you to provide some overviews of some of the innovative things that we have done. And we really believe that through some work that we did, thanks to the 2016 Interim Legislative Committee on some allocation of a small amount of funds, we were able to do a really successful job in piloting this state matching program that we're going to talk to you about today. As Representative Marsh said, there may be other opportunities to consider in terms of this particular program continuing to go forward, but again, we want to be able to focus on the results that we have been able to provide so far to six school districts. Before I turn it over to Carla to go through the presentation, I just want to say for us, the Department of Education, I mean, clearly there's a huge mission as we reach out and try to make sure that our students, our teachers, and our district staff are provided with the necessary tools and information they need to help our Oregon students be successful. And clearly, as we move forward with advanced tools and digital learning, the importance of having adequate internet services and being able to gain this kind of information in the classroom, it's becoming more and more important. Many of our rural parts of the state, there is, and as I think Alex had alluded to, there are many areas of the state that don't have the necessary bandwidth that they need to be able to do this. This is an opportunity for us, as we have demonstrated through our pilot program, to make those costs associated with expanding that broadband make it possible for them. So again, very excited to share this with you, and certainly I know Carla will provide information as it relates to the program.
Chair Gomberg, representatives of the committee, my name is Carla Wade, and I am the Digital Innovations Lead at the Oregon Department of Education. I'm here today to tell you a little bit about the E-Rate program and the pilot programs that we've run over the course of the last couple of years. E-Rate is a federal program that's been designed to assist schools and libraries in the cost, the high costs for internet connectivity and networks in the systems. It's calculated both on poverty, the free and reduced lunch rate in the school districts, as well as their urban or rural status. To motivate state leaders to fund new broadband construction, the FCC unveiled a new dedicated state match in December of 2014 as a part of the E-Rate Modernization Order. The state match funding was first made available to our applicants in fiscal year 2016. As a part of the E-Rate Modernization Order, the FCC adopted bandwidth targets that were recommended by the State Educational Technology Directors Association, calling for an external internet connection to the internet service provider of at least 1 gigabyte per second per 1,000 students and staff, and an internal wide area network connection from the district to each school and among schools within the district of at least 10 gigabytes per second per 1,000 students or staff. This was the first time these kinds of recommendations had been set by both educators and industry experts from around the country. Under these new rules, the FCC would provide eligible applicants with up to a 10% additional discount for special construction charges, matching state funding for the project on a dollar-to-dollar basis. A district with 40% discount rate could receive up to an additional 10% of E-rate funds if the state provides that additional 10% of the cost in a special construction project. Applicants with higher discount rates that utilize these funds have the opportunity to significantly or even completely eliminate their payment obligations. For example, if construction costs are $500,000, the district has a 40% discount, and the state invests 10% of the construction costs, or $50,000, then E-Rate will match dollar for dollar up to another $50,000. In May of 2016, the legislature, through the Emergency Board, appropriated $252,762 to the Oregon Department of Education to support 6 pilot districts with state match funds. These were districts that had plans in place and were ready to begin construction. The $240,062 of state matching funds enabled 6 local school districts to receive an additional $1,988,210 of federal resources for project costs. These funds, combined with $172,000 of local school districts funds, ensured the completion of all 6 projects and provided for a 1-to-10 leverage with the state investment. In terms of the $60 million we estimate based on preliminary numbers for the remaining schools and districts, we are assuming the same type of leveraging of resources, both federal and local. To give you an idea about the potential of the impact, let's look at some of the pilots. The Columbia Gorge Education Service District pilot included South Wasco, Duffer, and Sherman County. These districts were working off microwave internet. Bandwidth-intensive services like streaming services, online applications, and testing were difficult to access across many devices at the same time. At times, they were utilizing their entire connection and then having a bottleneck resulting in slowed internet access. In places like Maupin, Oregon, if two people were streaming a video, a classroom of 30 would not have enough bandwidth to take the state-mandated test. And it's not unusual in some of our schools for someone to have to go shovel the snow off the satellite dish before they can run the state assessment. Without the state-matched funds, these fiber builds would have been extremely difficult, if not impossible, to fund in a region of our size. This is from Wasco County. When we were looking at building fiber to these sites, we were in a situation where we had to consider paying up to 13% of the installation costs. It likely would have resulted in our building to just one site, not all three. That's a difficult decision to make, because who do you choose? Each district has its own challenges and needs, and no one district is more or less important than another. The state match funds made it possible for us to serve all of our districts at once, which has had a huge positive impact across the region. Sandyam Canyon was another successful pilot. They were transitioning learning, and that transition, the transition to the new learning styles with more online learning, called for increased connectivity. As Sandyam Canyon was in the process of building capacity of devices, systems, and professional development to facilitate the shift in learning through the integration of digital tools, district-wide connectivity to both the LAN and WAN was critical. With an aging inter-district infrastructure, both reliability and capacity were of strong concern. Full implementation of digital learning tools required both greater capacity and greatly reduced risk of network failure. One of the benefits that both of the districts, or both of the pilots, these pilots reported, was that their parents are seeing more confidence in the school districts because of what they're able to provide for their children, and the community is feeling more livable because of the increased access. While the E-Rate program greatly facilitates bringing digital learning tools to school districts across Oregon, the gap between E-Rate funding and the total project cost can be a major challenge to rural districts faced with a wide array of budget priorities. The means to bridge this gap that the state match provides may be the critical component of the project that enables success of the project and facilitates long-range student success. In addition, with the opportunity, with the complexity and timeline of E-rate funding proposals, a high level of state match program flexibility is needed. E-rate projects aimed for implementation in a certain budget year may cross into a new budget year due to E-rate funding proposal review delays, permit delays, a variety of things. Approval process can be extremely slow, requiring districts to roll construction into the following year. Within this process, districts must balance budget shifts, vendor relationships, and potentially state match grants. It's critical that the state match policies we develop take into account the challenges presented by the E-rate funding process. Based on a subset of data from fall of 2017, we know that we have at least 59 public schools and at least 24 different districts that are not connected to the internet with scalable technology. Our students live and learn in a digital world. Access to high-speed broadband and K-12 education is no longer an afterthought. Instead, it's fundamental for implementing the student-centered learning models critical for preparing our students for college and careers. Access to high-speed broadband and K-12 education is an equity issue. Where you live should not determine your access to high-speed connectivity.
Mr. Chairman, I just might add, I know that Carla had talked specifically as it relates to the six pilot projects. projects, and I think she had provided you an example of a project that, let's say, had a 40% discount rate under the normal FCC program. When we did the six pilots, we reached, and obviously we couldn't do everything. There was only a limited amount of resources that the legislature could appropriate. So we really focused on the highest poverty school districts and the most rural, and what those carried was very high percentage discount rates, 70-80% is what they got in the typical FCC program. However, you know, if you're in a very high poverty area, rural, it's very difficult, even if you're getting that percentage, to be able to meet the gap, because that's basically what was happening, is many school districts would turn away the opportunity because they couldn't meet that gap. Basically, with the state match program, the state came in and was able to provide another 10%, which gave the additional 10% of federal funds. In four of those six projects, basically the entire project got paid for with the state match and federal resources. Two of the projects still had a small gap, but it was a much smaller gap that they could afford, and there was some local resources put in it. So again, all school districts are different. They all fall different in terms of what percentage, what rate they would get through the FCC, but the ones that benefit the most are going to be those in your rural and high poverty areas.
Well, thank you. Any questions for this panel, colleagues? Representative Marsh.
So just to clarify, and you touched on this, but I think it's important to have it just as clear as possible. We've participated in the matching program with the FCC in the past, but it would be helpful to have a structured fund available to administer the program. And can you explain exactly why?
Chair Goldberg, Representative Marsh, thank you for the question. Indeed, we pilot this program with just a general fund appropriation. However, under that, we had to be very, very prescriptive because there, as we all know, there is a time limit in terms of the usage of state general fund money. We did not have a rolling account that could move like typical construction projects. You're going to run into delays. In these cases, we had to really choose ready to proceed districts that we could spend all the dollars within the appropriate time. So without the fund, we were somewhat limited in who we could choose. With a fund that becomes more flexible, that perhaps goes across biennial time frames, because again, like Carlos said, there are delays that are associated with construction, there are delays that are associated with application, but with having that type of fund, we could cast a much broader net in terms of school districts that we could fund. I would also add to that, Representative Marsh, I think it sends a very strong signal, too. And again, part of this matching program was the FCC program was not getting school districts to use it as much as they would like to see. So this is really incentivize the usage of that. By setting up a fund, it does establish a signal to the FCC that this is an important program and an important investment for the state.
Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. One, this was really good. And thank you for bringing this to us. I had no idea. And, I mean, anything we can do to make things better for our kids in school, I mean, this is amazing. I really appreciate this. But I would be remiss if I did not mention the prowess, the coaching ability prowess of Mr. Krager, who is here today. 15, 16 years ago, he beat me many, many times in Little League baseball coaching. It was not because of my son's lack of abilities or his son's prowess. It was his coaching prowess. And I just think that the committee needs to know that. This guy was a great Little League coach.
Well, I'm glad you brought me.
Always.
Well, thank you for that additional commentary. And I'm going to, on that happy note, excuse this panel. And Representative Marsh, you said you might have a concept for us.
I do. I'll just go down there. It'll take me longer to go down here and give you the concept.
Anytime I hear about Representative Post being beaten on a regular basis, brightens my afternoon.
Wow.
What happened to civil bipartisanship?
Thank you, Chair Gomberg and colleagues. I wanted to just present to you for your consideration a concept that I have been thinking about for a while, and that if there is interest here, I would suggest that we develop as a concept for consideration in the short session as part of our broadband bill. I've been serving for the last 8 months or so on the Broadband Advisory Council, which is a statewide council. I like to say it's comprised of many smart nerds and me, very definitely not in the smart nerd category, but very passionate about the concept of spreading broadband to the rural parts of our state. Again, because I think that it is such a critical part of any kind of economic development activities. So my observation in sitting on the council is that broadband in Oregon has really been an entrepreneurial enterprise. Our most robust systems that exist out there have resulted from the presence of a community champion that recognizes creative and often multiple ways to construct systems. Of course, not all rural communities have such a champion or have that kind of expertise on site. And our challenge then, I think, is to look at how we maximize the kind of expertise and wisdom that we already have in many places of the state in regard to rural broadband and use that to the benefit of other corners where that expertise doesn't exist. Accordingly, the concept that I've developed is a simple one, low-tech, pretty cheap, called the Rural Broadband Mentor Program. What the Rural Broadband Mentor Program would do is to basically request that Business Oregon establish a program structure that would enable us to really assist broadband startups in the same way that we assist other startups with some coaching, some identification of resources, and some assistance as the program enrolls. Since we don't have an allocation to put toward the development of a rural broadband mentor program right now, so our legislative directive in this session would simply be to Business Oregon to develop the program structure, including first, a panel of qualified individuals and entities who exist within the state who are doing good work in many communities and who could serve as mentors to other communities. Secondly, developing the list of possible activities, including potentially initial project assessment, plan development, ongoing consultation. And third, simply developing the program structure and application process, funding requirements, that kind of thing. It is important to note that Business Oregon is currently rolling out a rural broadband capacity pilot program with the use of $500,000 that they've received from the Strategic Reserve Fund, and that will be allocated to local projects, which are now in the process of applying for that funding. So in the future, should that pilot program continue, I believe that the Rural Broadband Mentor Program would be a very useful subset and appropriately located within that bigger program. So that's a small idea. Again, it's a matter of looking at the wisdom and the expertise that we have in the state and saying, how can we use that for the best benefit to really begin to roll out and build capacity in the far corners of Oregon?
Excellent. Questions? Yes, Representative.
Okay, this time I'm dead serious. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Marsh, I made a note to myself with this. Just in case, would it be good to maybe narrow the relating clause to rural? Just inserting the word rural, just because from what you just said.
This program is specifically, what I'm anticipating is specifically oriented toward rural broadband. The relating clause in the bill, I don't know that, can we change that at this point?
Not at this point.
Oh, you can't?
Mm-mm.
Hey, I'm learning.
So what we're looking at today is really several different legislative concepts.
Sorry for interrupting,
please.
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair.
My understanding is you can change the relating to clause until the bill is filed.
Okay. I thought so. And you're right, and it could be an LC fight. I guess because when I read the LC as relating to broadband technology, if just rural was stuck in there, it might make a lot more sense for a lot of people. Just a thought.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Marsh. And I'm just going to ask the committee to stand at ease for just a moment. We're back on the record, and I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I was just clarifying the fact that, yes, we can indeed change a relating to clause until a bill is filed, but it's our intention to file that bill this afternoon, and there's no time to do that in the next 20 minutes. If we were to wait and try and file it another time, we'd miss the deadline for bill introduction. So our options are a bill relating to broadband or not.
And I was just taking a couple minutes to clarify that with some committee members. All right, colleagues, is there anything else that we want to cover this afternoon relating to broadband? Other than when we get to the actual introduction to bills? All right, the third LC draft that we've got is Legislative Concept 82. And I would say to you that this is simply a placeholder. The measure that you have before you refers to a study. We're not looking for any kind of study. We're not planning to pursue a study. We're simply just crafting a document that we can use should we want to pursue other economic development options in the coming weeks. Any questions about that? All right. Then we've set aside some time this afternoon. If any of the members have any bills that they anticipate may be coming toward this committee and wanted to give get an opportunity to sit down with the committee and warn us about what they've got in mind and take some time now in case time grows short later. And that option is open to members that are on the committee and members that are not on the committee, although I don't see any in the audience. Anybody got anything they want to share with us, or do you want to move further on into the agenda? Going once? Going twice? That I will close the information session, and I am going to open a work session on the introduction of committee legislative concepts. And colleagues, let me say that without the intent to seem critical, there are times I've seen committees introduce a number of legislative concepts as committee bills without going in any detail about what they concern. I certainly believe that in this committee that we have gone through some detail, some might say too much detail, in identifying what the content of some of the measures are that we want to introduce and also their evolution to the point of a committee bill, even if it is simply a placeholder. I have also seen from time to time some criticism of the committee bill process, saying that that the introduction of anonymous bills is not appropriate. I would certainly not refer to these as anonymous bills. When we do take the opportunity to vote on them, that is a vote for introduction and does not indicate whether you would choose to support or oppose the bill in its final form and how it may evolve. It is simply a vote to introduce them and to move that process forward. But I would also say to you, if anybody questions the responsibility for introduction of any of these measures, I don't look to claim any credit for that, but I will take responsibility if there's any to be assessed. So that being said, co-chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just want to say that I appreciate the work on the broadband pieces, especially as Representative Fahey and I went to the Wireless U mm-hmm. conference down in San Francisco last summer, and broadband, you know, and 5G, and the technology that's going to be occurring over the next year or 2 years is just going to be amazing. And all of that has to be done with fiber and broadband and the expansion. And so the sooner that we can roll that out and get it across the state, the more ability that those programs and those possibilities will be out there, not just in urban Oregon, but in rural Oregon.
Thank you, Co-Chair. We are in work session. Co-Chair Brock Smith, would you care to share any motions with us?
Sure. Chair Gomberg, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills: LC 81, dated 11/20/2017. LC 82, dated 12/14/2017, and LC 83, dated 1/8/2018.
Thank you. Representative Brock Smith moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills, and that is LC 81, dated 11/20/17, LC 82, dated 12/14/17, and LC 83, dated 1/8/2018. Is there any discussion? Again, colleagues, several of these are placeholders, and there's the intention to see them expanded and augmented. If you have any interest in the broadband bill, please contact Representative Marsh, who's working on that. I know Representative Reschke had some interest in that and was not able to join us today. I regret his excused absence, but he'll be involved in that process. The economic development bill is an opportunity if you see any issues that you think we need to move forward on. Is there any other discussion, questions, or comments? Is there any objection to the introduction of these three measures then? Seeing none,
The motion carries. And is there anything else for the good of the order before we adjourn today, colleagues? Well, Representative Helfrich, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. Rosenberg, you're with us today. Are you going to be a regular, or just we're looking for some excitement, so decided to come on down. All right. Well, colleagues, I'll look forward to seeing you when we reconvene. If there's nothing else, I will go ahead and adjourn the meeting.